Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Angry immigration politics and militiamen at the border aside, here's the news. The floodgate of illegal immigrants from Mexico is over. There certainly was a flood, millions for decades. But it's ended, or the numbers are anyway way, way down, and the reasons are interesting on both sides of the border, especially in Mexico. This hour on Point, the decline of illegal immigration from Mexico and what it means. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the fall off in undocumented newcomers from Mexico in your town, your work? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Tijuana, Mexico, is Damian Cave, correspondent with the New York Times. He wrote a big front page article in yesterday's paper headlined, Better Lives for Mexicans Cut Allure of Going North. Damian Cave, welcome.
Thank you.
What are the numbers?
The numbers have been, over the past few years, it's basically been an 80% drop in terms of new arrivals and people who have been overstaying their visas. So what was once, in the 500,000 a year figure is now sort of around 100,000, at least according to the best estimates that we have.
That's a great big fall off. We'll look at why, but a lot of our listeners think they already know. I mean, we've got a lot of people writing in online, Damian, saying, big surprise, U.S. economy, goes in the tank, and of course nobody's coming.
Well, that's been the conventional wisdom for quite a while, and it's clear that the American economy is a factor. But I think what my reporting shows and what I sort of discovered along the way here is that it's much more complicated than that. And if you think about it, it's always been more complicated. The first waves of immigrants that came from Mexico, it was more about what was happening in Mexico. It was about an economic crisis in the early 80s and an economic crisis in the mid-90s. So there's always been this push-pull, and so now it's just that the dynamic has changed, where in Mexico there are more educational opportunities, there are more economic opportunities, there's also crime at the border that acts as a sort of buffer where no one wants to cross through this really dangerous area. So there's a number of factors. It's not just good, but the bottom line is that the dynamic has changed significantly. And then when you compare the quality of life in Mexico in, say, a small town versus the quality of life in the United States where it's hard to find work and maybe they are always asking you for papers and it's $5,000 to cross the border and you might get killed by criminals, well, it's not surprising that a lot of people say, you know what, maybe I don't want to do it. But the idea that it's just the American economy, I think, is an oversimplification. And it's a particularly American oversimplification where we tend to look at what's happening on that side of the border and that's it.
But you can understand why people might have that. I mean, the economy has been terrible here. Many fewer jobs for everybody in recent years. And then, I mean, look at here's Time Magazine, the recent issue. You've no doubt seen it. But, great big photo on the front of handmade grave crosses in Mexico, I guess. And the headline, The War Next Door, it makes Mexico look like a war zone that people would want to get out of there. But you're saying Mexico itself has an attraction, a pull now that it didn't have before. What are the elements of that?
I mean, this is the thing. It's really complicated, and this is something that people on both sides of the immigration debate often overlook. It's not as simple as they would like it to be. So while the violence is clearly a major problem for Mexico, in a lot of ways that actually acts as a deterrent for the majority of Mexicans. If you live along the border, yes, you're going to maybe move to El Paso or maybe you're going to stay there a few nights a week instead of in Juarez because it's safer. But the vast majority of the Mexican population does not live at the border, and so for the people who live south of there, they're hearing stories of their cousins, other uncles, brothers, maybe being killed or kidnapped as they try to cross. And so they're saying, you know what, it's not worth it. So it's true that it does actually drive some people into the United States, but far fewer or far more actually are saying, you know what, it's not worth it. So it's not that crime isn't a factor. It's that it's a complicated factor and there's some nuance to it.
That illegal crossing of the border has never been a snap, but you're saying now the sort of drug war in Mexico has made that a kind of war zone more and more along the border that Mexicans themselves are shying away from. But it's not just that. You're saying there's more reason back in the village to stay home. Paint that picture for us, Damian.
Well, I spent a lot of time in this small town in Jalisco State, which for a century has been one of the top states for Mexican immigrants. It's where, the young men, they turned 18, they all went to the United States. And this has been going on since the 20s. But when I spent time with this one family, the Orozcos, that have been a part of that for a long time, the youngest people in the family were studying engineering or working in the government office. And there was a sense that they didn't really want to go. I mean, I was at this new technological institute in this small town in Arandas in the middle of the highlands. And I was in this engineering class, and I asked all 30 students or 29 students, one, tell me, are you more educated than your parents by being here? And they all raised their hands. And I said, how many of you want to go to the United States to work or to live? And they all, and none of them raised their hands. You know, I mean, this is a dramatic cultural shift. I mean, as recently as 10 years ago, at least half of those kids would have raised their hands and said, okay, yeah, I just have to go to the United States. There's nothing here for me. So, you know, this is sort of a cultural change that surprised me, frankly, when I was in these small towns. And it's not just in the classrooms. It's also in places like the Shrine for Migrants and also in Jalisco, where people have been coming to pray for people crossing for a long, long time. And the people there told me, you know, in the old days, people would come and say, I hope them pray that my brother, my husband, my son gets across the border, you know, without dying because of the desert. Now they're all there praying for papers. And this is another change.
You know, papers, there's legal access to the United States. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. There are more opportunities. While there still may not be enough, there's a perception that it's better to go with papers, to go legally, and that it's possible in a way that it wasn't before.
So the fact that they're in school, these young people who you asked, do they want to go to the States, and so many, or, you know, are they better educated? And they're saying, no, they'll stay there. They are better educated. The fact they're in school is one big clue. But what else? What about the wage differential? Is it what it was when their fathers or grandfathers would go to the States, come back, go to the States and come back?
No, and not at all. And that's an important point. I mean, a lot of people think, well, unemployment in Mexico is what drives immigration. And in fact, a lot of what it is the differential between what you earn in Mexico versus what you earn in the United States. It's still the case that you can earn more in the United States, but over time that number has shrunk and sort of altered a bit. So when this family's grandfather or father in this case actually went in the mid-50s, the differential was 10 to 1. You can make 10 times as much in the United States as you could in this small town in Jalisco. And then, you know, now it's probably somewhere lower than 3 or around there. And that's, you know, it's still significant. But because of the recession in the United States has pushed down wages for immigrants in particular, and because in Mexico the economy has been growing at 5%, you know, the differential is narrowed. So, you know, there are more opportunities. There is work, even if it's not as well paid as it is in the United States. And this actually fits with research that's been going on for years. For a long time, it's been clear that people give up jobs in Mexico to go to the United States. So that's another sign that it's the differential that matters a little bit more than whether or not you actually work or not.
And then there's family planning and family size, you say, Damien, when it comes to how Mexicans are looking at whether to stay or whether to go to the U.S.
And this is another important, slow-moving kind of tectonic change. In 1970, the average Mexican family had almost seven kids per family. Now we're down to 2, according to government figures. And it's just beginning to sort of hit where these cohorts that were born in the 90s are now coming of age into the labor market. And so there's just fewer Mexicans. There's fewer young Mexicans who need work. You know, and the example that sort of comes to mind that I couldn't even get in the story was my taxi driver in Jalisco, who was one of 16 kids. And he said he and most of his brothers had crossed illegally into the United States 3-4 times when they were younger. But now he has 4 kids. And he said, you know, my kids only want to go to the United States for vacation. And I said, well, what if they don't get a job? And he said, you know what, if they have a hard time, because there's only 4 of them, me and my wife can help them out. And so that kind of speaks to the dynamic change that comes not just from having fewer kids. It means less pressure. There's less pressure demographically, there's less pressure economically to leave.
You know, I was also wondering, though, Damien, with now we're told that there's something like 11 or 12 million undocumented folks in this country. Now, of course, they're not all by any means from Mexico, but Mexico's been the biggest source or was for a long time. Maybe there are so many relatives here in the States now working and sending back support that they don't need to go, that there's such a big undocumented population and more than that in the States now that, you know, the pipeline for cash coming back is there. They've got the family in the States to help out if necessary. Why should any more go?
That's definitely part of it. I mean, there is, you know, in this small town, there's a lot of pickup trucks with Texas plates. You know, there's a lot of people who have gone to the States, worked, improve their family's life and come back and now they're staying, or there's somebody there who's sending money back. So that is an interesting factor. I mean, the United States and Mexico are still going to have to deal with the consequences of these decades of immigration. I mean, there are still a lot of illegal immigrants in the United States, and this is something that, you know, United States politicians have really yet to tackle. They're too busy talking about the border. So, you know, this is an issue that I think is going to have long-term effects even with the decline in illegal traffic. There are a lot of questions that are still unanswered.
You quote Doug Massey, at Princeton, the Mexican Migration Project there, saying that for the first time in 60 years, the net traffic, and I guess he means coming north from Mexico to the U.S., has gone to zero and is probably a little bit negative. I mean, whatever the reason, that's a gigantic turnaround from that 500,000 plus a year we saw less than 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's important to note. This has happened relatively quickly, but some of the numbers, I mean, some of the things that Massey's research shows, I mean, getting to this point of is it just the economy, the decline in interest in going to the United States as a first-time migrant started to drop around 2000. So long before the recession, there were Mexicans who were starting to say, you know what, maybe I don't need to go, or maybe it's not worth it. You know, you have to keep in mind this was also a time when Mexico really had its first democratic election was around 2000. So again, factors in Mexico are clearly important in changing the dynamic. And that net negative, what he means is actually, just to clarify, mm-hmm. it means that the number of people coming in is now equal to or less than those going home, either yeah. voluntarily or through deportations. There's yeah. been a huge jump in deportations, and that's a factor too.
We're going to look at all of it with Damien Cave of the New York Times and more. Damien, please stand by there in Mexico. We're talking about illegal immigration from Mexico plummeting. Why and what it means for Mexico and the USA. Listeners, have you seen it? The fall off in new illegal immigrants from Mexico. Have you seen it in your town, your work? Do you believe it? How do you explain it? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Total que no haya trabajo y sin papeles peor. Si los que son residentes no consiguen menos, yo mejor me vine pa' mi tierra, mi pueblito sin sonsán. He comprendido que en todito más bonito en Michoacán. Ahora trabajo en el campo, trabajo de sol a sol, y ahora estoy con mi familia y cada vez mucho mejor. ¡Puro! Adiós gringos peleoneros, buenos pa' las guerras. Ellos creen que Dios es blanco y es más moreno que yo.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about illegal immigration from Mexico plummeting. The number's way, way down. We're looking at why and what it means for Mexico and the USA. A lot of Mexicans have come and come for a long time, but it has never been easy. Even now, new movie out just last month called A Better Life. Here's a bit where from the trailer, an illegal Mexican immigrant in East L.A. struggles to keep his son, born in the U.S., out of gang life.
This country is a land of dreams. It can be a hard place, a cruel place, but it's where I work. And I dream of a better life for my son.
Dreaming of a better life, but not all Mexican. Damien Cave reports in the New York Times are dreaming of doing that in the U.S. now. The dynamics that have brought people for so long in such numbers, quite clear. Here's Mexican President Felipe Calderon talking with CBS last November about the illegal immigration problem. He said the heart of the issue is, of course, these two economies side by side and their differences.
It's almost a textbook case in which two factors, labor and capital, needs to work together. And the real solution for migration in the long term is to provide better opportunities for Mexican people in Mexico.
Damien Cave reports that in part that is happening, but this is still a loaded issue. President Obama in May went to El Paso, Texas, renewed his call for immigration reform, said the opportunities for immigrants have made this country great over a long period of time, history. But when it comes to immigration policy, it is a delicate balance, especially now.
The truth is, we've often wrestled with the politics of who is and who isn't allowed to come into this country. This debate is not new. At times, there's been fear and resentment directed towards newcomers, especially in hard economic times.
And we've had them. Several states implementing draconian laws to go after undocumented folks in the U.S. Last month, Alabama passed one of the toughest immigration laws yet, requires public schools to check the citizenship status of students, makes it a crime to knowingly give a ride to an illegal immigrant. After that law was signed by Republican Alabama State Senator Scott Basin, among others, Basin explained why he sponsored the legislation.
Our concern is the number of illegal immigrants entering into the state and taking jobs away from the people of Alabama. I've told many people that this is actually probably the largest economic development job creation bill that the state of Alabama has ever passed, because thousands and thousands and thousands of Alabamians have been displaced in the workforce, and they will have the opportunity now to take those jobs back.
Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Arizona, all with tough, tough laws aimed at undocumented aliens in this country. Damien Cave's writing about the fall off in the new population coming in illegally to this country in the New York Times just yesterday. Big story. Joins us today from Tijuana, Mexico. Damien, we've got a response here from people online. You know, one says, soon we'll all be jumping the fence the other way to find affordable health care services south of the border. The worm is turning. I don't know about that. That's a big turn indeed. But here's Damien. Ryan writes, I believe this is mainly due to the collapse of the housing market. But additionally, it could be America's growing concern to do something about illegal immigration because it threatens our economy. You've no doubt, Damien, seen these very tough laws in any number of states now. You mentioned them earlier, but how big a factor is that? Are Mexicans, you know, hearing what's going on, being stopped, jailed, deported, and all the rest, and saying, not worth going, you're going to run into trouble and be headed back?
You know, that's definitely a factor. I mean, I've heard that in Jalisco. I'm here in Tijuana, and I've been spending time at a bunch of the migrant shelters. And a lot of the deportees talk about the stress of always being afraid the police are going to stop you, you know, the sense that everyone is asking for papers. And this is a change from how it was as recently as the 80s or 90s when it was basically tacit approval. People didn't bother you. People didn't ask you for papers. But now, even in states where there aren't these tough laws, employers and institutions feel the need to be tougher on this issue. And so I do think it's affecting people. It's definitely deterring people from going north. It's one of the factors. But I also think that the question I think that the country has to grapple with is it worth it? I mean, is it worth sending back, you know, these people? There are certain people who clearly the country doesn't want, whether they're criminals, whoever it might be. But, you know, a lot of these migrant shelters are filled with people now who have families in the United States and have been in the United States since they were 2 or 4 or 6. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe they got in trouble when they were 17 and they were never able to get legal. So, you know, you're sending home a worker or a carpenter or somebody who, you know, maybe that's somebody you want in your society, maybe not. But that's the question I think the country has to sort of figure out is what are the benefits of sending everyone home sort of worth it? And even in states like Georgia and Alabama, I mean, some of the research I've seen is that they're already struggling with labor shortages in certain industries. And you know, if there is a return to a construction boom, which is probably unlikely for several years, then that would be one industry that would be affected. And it's interesting that listener brought that up because that is one of the reasons why some experts think that this change is sustainable and will continue, because the construction industry, which is where so many immigrants were concentrated, is nowhere near recovery and probably won't be for 5 years. You're potentially looking at a 10-year period of significantly declined Mexican immigration. So at that point, you have a bunch of kids who, you know, or who went from 18 to 28 and didn't go. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that creates a real change in a country.
Let's go to David in Chesapeake, Virginia. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah.
I've been keeping up with this whole Mexican and U.S. thing all the way back to when, I guess, the whole thing with the ATF came out supplying the cartels with 90% of the weapons that are causing murders.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty galling.
You know, that's a whole other issue.
But, yeah.
You know, there's several different points. You know, one, I have to agree with one of the points that you've made, I guess, or you've asked, which is, you know, is it really just the economy? And I've spoken to probably 200 people between South America and Mexico. The Mexicans, there are some things that have changed in their country, which are, you know, that are causing them to stay. But what I'm hearing from South Americans and Europeans and Mexicans is that it's solely because of the economy. One of the main purposes in which I think politicians try to divert this is that people come to this country not because they like our way of life and all that kind of stuff, like, you know, it's so much touted. They come here because in their country they do not have the opportunity to make the money that we do, and they come here and they know that Americans don't like to do a lot of the jobs that are considered, you know, typical jobs in their country. So they come here because they know they can fill that spot, and they know that they can make the money, which they do not have the opportunity in their own country. You know, and I think that a lot of the politicians are totally, you know, moving away from that. They don't want people to, think about that. They want to see it as, well, we're, you know, it's our borders, that we're making progress in other countries, when, you know, and that may be some, there may be some validity to that, but the ultimate bottom line is people are not coming to this country because they see that we're in a bad economic, you know, spill, and they cannot make the money that, you know, that they might have in the years past.
Yeah, David, we've got the point. Let me hold that for just a minute there. I mean, it's that attraction that we heard Felipe Calderon, the president, talk about in that little piece of tape. Let me hold that thought right there for just a minute and get one more call, if I may, here. North Augusta, South Carolina. Anthony, thank you for calling, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My first job out of culinary school, I was a four-year graduate of culinary school.
Yes.
I made $22.50 an hour at the Ritz-Carlton. My pay has steadily declined to the point now where employers tell me when I go for a job, why would I pay you $25 to $30 an hour when I can hire five, six illegals for that pay? It's so bad now that I'm getting out of the field completely, and I'm trying to get into the medical field. I'm trying to get into a physical therapy program or a nursing program.
Wow.
I'm 46 years old. I don't feel like going back to school.
But you feel like you've got to.
Yes, but my pay is so low because of the flood of the illegals.
But Anthony, can five or six people who came across the border do what you would do with 4 years of culinary school? I mean, you learned a lot there, presumably.
Yes, but apparently the owners feel like they can teach them the minimum what they need and get by with it that way.
Yeah.
My family came in through Ellis Island. All of my grandparents came from Italy and came in through Ellis Island, fought in World War II in Korea, and they did it legally. And I have tried to get employees of mine to fill out the documents so that I can keep them. I've never met a Mexican that I did not truly like. But they will not fill out the paperwork. They refuse to learn to speak English. And I'm now taking Spanish classes so that I can communicate with the people that I have to work with.
Anthony, we wish you luck with that new phase, and I'm sorry for what you've been up against there on the headwind. I mean, the world is a complicated place, and it sounds like the short end of the stick right there. Damien, as you listen to that, are the numbers that you're reporting, are they a sign of, I don't know what you want to call it, relief for Anthony, that he's not going to face that situation, or is it not really relevant because, you know, we've already got what we've got here?
It might be a sign of relief for Anthony's kids, but for Anthony, it may not be. I mean, this speaks to the point I was making earlier, that there's going to be a hangover from all the people that have come in for so long. And there is research showing that in certain industries, particularly low-skilled industries where – and not that cooking is low-skilled, but industries where there's an entry level, particularly for young people who don't necessarily have a college degree, those are the areas where there's significant wage competition and where there is – what he's describing is happening in some of these industries. The change is that there will be fewer of these people coming in as the group that's in the country now sort of ages on, as he does. But this is a challenge. Again, this gets to the point that what the country needs to really figure out what to do is what do you do with the people who were there already? Because the recession has hit. Not as many people are going home as people might have expected. If they were going to go home, they would have already gone home. And part of the reason they're not is because it's so hard to cross back. In the old days, and this is something that I think people need to understand too, there's this misconception out there that every Mexican who comes or every illegal immigrant who comes wants to stay in the United States forever. Historically, there's always been this circular flow, and most people want to work temporarily. They want to go home to their family for Christmas and come back or for a few months or whatever it might be. And that's been made a lot harder because of the changes at the border. So, you know, what you have here is the end of that sort of circular flow to some degree. And so the question is, what do you do with the people on either side?
Wow. Can't even go home if they want to, maybe, because of all that violence along the border and checks along the way. Damien Kay, please stand by there in Tijuana, Mexico. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Nashville, Tennessee, Catherine Donato, professor of sociology at Vanderbilt University. She studies international migration between Mexico and the United States. Professor Donato, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You've looked at this for a long time. You know the situation well. Were you surprised by what Damien's reporting this week about the very large fall off in the northbound illegal immigration traffic?
No, actually, I am part of the Mexican Migration Project and have been collecting data on that project and for other projects, doing a lot of work in Mexico over the years. And absolutely, I think he hit it right on the head. All of the changing trends that he talks about is really from, I think, the academic point of view, what we have always described Mexico-U.S. migration as. We've thought about it and described it as an intergenerational process where fathers pass the migration experience onto sons, and then sons become fathers and pass it on. And what has happened is all of these changes, more education, not only more educational opportunity, but the dispersion of educational facilities, as you said, you know, universities in small towns. So not only more kids are in school, but they have more opportunities for higher ed, you know, lower fertility, you know, all the issues in the U.S. And then, of course, the violence at the border, although to some extent it's affected states further down as well. I mean, all these things are coming together to break that intergenerational process of migration that we have essentially witnessed for the last 100 years.
So do you think, looking down the road, that that is breaking or is broken and we're not going to see that kind of flow again? Or this is just a pause related in part to the U.S. economic downturn, economy comes back, illegal immigration comes back?
Well, I mean, it's definitely related to the economy. The question is what's going to happen in this next probably decade or so, where, you know, in migration of unauthorized persons is way down or at zero. So what's going to happen in these next 5 to 10 years? First, as Damien said, we have to deal with the population that's here. That is not going to go away. Their kids are largely U.S. born, and that, you know, their lives are here, right? So we have to deal with that. Over the long term, I think it depends on a number of factors. It depends on how easy the communication is and the contact is between family members here and there. As Damien said, in a lot of small towns, I work in the state of San Luis Potosí, in a lot of small towns and small cities, Cerritos, for example, which is a city for 150 years has been sending migrants to the U.S., you can see lots of signs of the U.S. in that small city.
Sure.
But you know, what's going to happen in terms of how these populations are going to continue to communicate with each other and what the U.S. economy, how that's going to change in relation to the Mexican economy. Right now, it is true that if you have if you graduate from college in Mexico, odds are you have a higher chance of getting a good job in Mexico, given the economy is very strong there, than going to the U.S.
Well, explain that to us, because, you know, especially with the images of the drug war that's been going on in Mexico and tens of thousands of people dying in that, it's easy. There's a kind of disconnect here. It's easy to kind of see Mexico as a basket case, and yet you and Damien Cave are saying no. There's attraction here. There's an improvement. Economy, many more educational opportunities. You know, it can look like a war zone to Americans looking down through the headlines in the borderlands.
Yeah, I think that in the U.S. we have a tendency to depict Mexico in very negative ways, and those are the images we tend to pick up and proffer across, you know, all the possible communication modes. You know, in reality, I was just in Mexico City a couple of months ago. I have never been in Mexico City where I have felt more safe. It is true that if I go up to some of the northern ranchos, the really small towns in the northern part of the state of San Luis, which borders Tamaulipas and some of the border states. It is true. I mean, you don't feel safe there at all. But in Mexico City, it's like when I first started working on Mexican migration 25 years ago, Mexico City was the place that no one wanted to go to. I mean, I would go for business. I would give lectures, whatever I had to do there, and then leave. Fabulous city, a lot to see, but not a place I felt comfortable bringing my family. This time, you know, my young kids who speak fluent Spanish, it's like we all, and one looks very gringa, the other one doesn't. We all feel extremely safe now in Mexico City. What a surprise.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about illegal immigration from Mexico plummeting, looking at why and what it means for Mexico and the United States. From 2000 to 2004, it was running at a more than half a million a year, now below 100,000 illegal immigrants from Mexico annually, the estimates are. That is a big drop, down 80% by some estimates from its height. Damien Cave of the New York Times has been reporting on this. He joins us today from Tijuana, Mexico. Catherine Donato is a professor at Vanderbilt University. She's done a lot of work on this front. She joins us today from Nashville. We'll be joined in just a moment from Mexico City by economist Roberto Newell Garcia, but a couple of callers who have been waiting with many here. I apologize, but Desney calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Desney, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. What do you know?
Well, I know that I worked for 30 years in professional horse racing, thoroughbred racing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm African American.
Okay.
And we have a history in the sport. You'd be hard-pressed to find us in the sport today. I've had trainers tell me, you're a really great groom, but that guy just told me that he'll work for less than you.
And that's it?
Yeah. Which is a clear violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
Just for starters, so how do you feel about what you're hearing today here, Desney? What does it bring to mind for you?
I feel that there is an agenda in this country. There's a narrative that there are very few voices of dissent on the side of people who have been displaced in their jobs, because I loved my job.
Mm-hmm.
I loved what I did. You know, I feel like people describe the work that I did as unskilled, but I would dare anybody to walk into a stall not knowing what they're doing with a thoroughbred racehorse.
Fully acknowledged, fully acknowledged. And yet that's gone away, and you see it, you attribute that to immigration, or maybe more than a tribute. You've actually seen it.
Yes.
Desney, we hear it loud and clear. Let me hold that thought, if I may, and I appreciate your calling in very much. Good luck. I hope you find your way back to a good stable one way or another. Let me get one more right here. Norfolk, Virginia, Francisco. Francisco, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, Tom, this you're usually on point, and then you're targeting here something that I've been working on for many years about illegal immigration.
Yeah.
Whenever there is illegal immigration, there is a situation of arbitrage. That means labor pays more in some places than others.
Of course.
And in the United States, that used to be the case. Now, some people are focusing that happened only in low-skilled jobs, like the culinary or the horse trainer, whatever. That is a no-brainer.
Okay? Yeah,
that's
yeah.
happening everywhere in the world. However, that has been happening in the high-skilled, too. I used to hire people to teach at the universities from India. Now I cannot find them. Then I went to China. I cannot find them because India and China are paying better than we are. The world is, when Shanghai, which is mm-hmm. as good or perhaps in some areas better than New York, when Shanghai wants to do a project, they do not benchmark with New York. Shanghai benchmarks with Singapore. The world has changed.
But what are you, Francisco, if I may, what are you saying then? Anthony called in, went to 4 years of culinary school, worked in the field. He can't make a living there anymore. Desney loved working with horses. Same story for her. Are you saying they should just accept that? That's just the way of the world?
No, Tom, no. They should prepare themselves for better opportunities. Okay? There is a lot of opportunities. However, that takes commitment. But my point of calling you mm-hmm. is that we are focusing just on this data that is happening now about the decrease. This has been going on for many years. They said it's in 2000. We have observing this. Okay, in the high-skilled jobs, we start observing that about 1995 when we couldn't hire some Chinese professors here.
Yeah.
Okay. So this has been going on. The issue is that unlike Europe, we were sold on NAFTA, the free trade agreement. But free trade is only for goods, not for services. The world has changed. If we don't go into a North American Union, this is not going to be solved. Okay, there is no reason why a Mexican can come here. There is no reason why an American cannot go to Mexico to work in a free way.
Francisco, you've got a big kind of high concept view of this, and I get it. And you're saying, you know, arbitrage will work itself out over time. On the other hand, there's Anthony, there's Desney saying, wait a minute, that was my job that went out the window, and they're not too happy about it. But we've got that perspective as well. Let me, if I may, bring a Mexican economist into this conversation. That might be a good point for it right there. Roberto Newell Garcia joins us now from Mexico City. He is vice president of the Mexican Institute for Competitiveness. It's a privately funded think tank there. He served as Mexico's secretary for agribusiness earlier in the 2000s. Roberto Newell Garcia, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, how are you, Tom? Nice to hear your voice.
It's nice to hear you as well. Damian Cave's been reporting on the latest on this big fall off in illegal immigration to the United States. We put that out there, and you know, then you may have heard just now, but we're hearing from Americans, well, okay, but I already lost my job. And then from Francisco just calling in, kind of saying, well, we all have to be one big labor market here ultimately to make this work out. Do you see unending pressure for Mexicans to go north to the United States, or an economy, a culture in Mexico that's going to increasingly keep Mexicans, people, home?
I see a bit of both, and I agree with the last caller's commentaries at a very high level. This is a process that's been working itself out for many decades, and it hits different parts of the labor markets at different rates of speed, depending on the relative scarcity of given skills. For some decades, the lack of opportunity in Mexico created strong incentives for us to seek better opportunities for ourselves in the United States. I agree with Damien's analysis that they were particularly after that gap in income levels. And as that gap has become smaller, the incentives for us to move to the United States have certainly diminished. And this started to happen at the high-skill job level much earlier. For a long time, we were victims of a brain drain of sorts. Our best and brightest were leaving Mexico to find opportunities in the United States because the American market was providing them at higher rates and better income levels. And clearly, this is now starting to reflect itself in many other domains of the economy. And frankly, as a Mexican, I feel that that's a blessing.
Yeah, we can understand that, absolutely. I mean, if things are better in Mexico, that's good all the way around. Catherine Donato says that there's long been this cycle of people who would come and go, and that would be passed on to their children. She says that, you know, that cycle may now be broken. Do you see that, or is this a temporary pause as the U.S. economy has been in the doldrums?
I think we probably are very close to a permanent turning point if we haven't turned that corner already. It's a little hard to tell because the U.S. economy is in such a deep trough that there might be an unusual aspect or an unusual nature to the situation that the U.S. is living, as is probably the case for Mexico as well. You are at a particularly bad point, and we're in a pretty good point, and those conditions have not been commonly the case. But I do think that the demographics, the immigration policies, the relative income opportunities that are emerging in both countries all are pointing in the same direction. So if we haven't reached that point where we will never, see equally high migration rates to the United States as we did in the past, yet we are certainly very close to the turning point. And I do think that this was in the cards, and frankly, it's great to see the demographics of Mexico finally start to show in the migration flows.
Here's a comment from a listener online, Jim, who's worried about this trend. He's taking the opposite point of view. He says, there goes our, the U.S., competitive edge as a low-cost agricultural superpower. Americans don't know how illegal workers absorb jobs Americans don't want to have. As an economist, what about that, Roberto Newell Garcia? Do you see that?
I think your caller is just bang on with that commentary. There are several sectors that are likely to lose competitiveness rather rapidly because, in fact, they were being made competitive by the presence of a fairly significant supply of Mexican skilled laborers. Agriculture is certainly probably the most outstanding case, but construction, services in general, even some manufacturing sectors were buoyed somewhat artificially by the presence of undocumented migrants to the United States.
Mr. Neil Garcia, please stand by there in Mexico City. Let me take a call from Spartanburg, South Carolina, if I may. Ref is calling. Hi, Ref, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I had a couple of points.
Yeah.
I'm a truck driver, and I've been living in Matamoros, Mexico, which is across the border from Brownsville, Texas, and
right.
I've been living there for 11 years now, you know, because I'm trying to work, you know, trying to bring my family over here, and my kids already got their citizenship by me, so now, you know, I'm just working on my wife.
So are you a U.S. citizen or Mexican or both
yes,
at this point, Ruff?
No. I'm a U.S. citizen born in Toledo, Ohio.
Oh, got it. Okay. Okay.
I'm not really too sure. I don't really agree about giving all these illegals, the free citizenship. Because I mean, like I said, I mean, I've been there for 11 years, and I mean, so like I'm trying to do it the right way, and these people are just okay. They're here for so many years, and so like I'm doing it, All these years I'm trying to do it the right way, but
Right, you're trying to still get your wife and family across, and why? Of course, just to be with you, I assume, but what about this idea that life is better in Mexico now, Rev?
No, well, the only thing that's better over there is just everything is cheap. I mean, you pay your light bill, your water bill, the rent, everything, you're looking at $300 per month, and then also it depends on which city you're living at, because right now, like right there, like in Matamoros, it's not really that dangerous like it is in Ciudad Juarez or, these other places. But, like, this woman that was calling earlier, she said that in Mexico City it's safer. And, I say that's not true. I mean, that's like, I mean, you know, when you hear people saying, like, hey, you know, we're going to Mexico City, I'm like, whoa, you know, be careful because, I mean, you know what, be sure you even make it there because, I mean, you might get stopped along the way and you might see some cops that are dressed as soldiers or as cops, but they're actually cartels. So, I mean, it's like it's very dangerous to even be in the roads. I mean, but the reason I'm calling is because some people come over here because, as I see it, they work 80 hours in these well-known factories, Alcoa and Delphi, and they put 80 to 100 hours a week.
In Mexico.
Yes, they do. And they only make like $75 to $90 a week. So, like, I was telling my wife, like, you know what? That's preposterous. It's like you work one day. Tomorrow you're not going to get paid. You work the same hours, and the next day you will get paid. I'm like, that's why they come over here because, I mean, even if they come over here and work at a McDonald's, I mean, a check of $180, it's great for them over there because it's very cheap. That's why, you know, that's what I was saying. And also people that go to universities and study 4 years about, let's say, out of 100 that graduate and get their degree, whatever, they only 12 actually get to become architects, or, you know, whatever they study for.
Hey, Riff, I appreciate your call. Yeah, our time is short, but I take your point. I wish you luck with your wife and family, bringing them over right, as you say. Damien Cave, our time is growing short here, but you mentioned something earlier I wanted to be sure to swing back to, and that is about, we're talking here about illegal immigration from Mexico, but what about on the legal front? One of our listeners said, you know, you said Mexicans these days would rather go with papers legally to the U.S., and that is more possible now than before. The listener asks, how so? What's going on that front, Damien?
Well, again, this is complicated. There have been some improvements in terms of temporary visas that are moving much faster. The wait times have dropped for a lot of other visas for permanent residents. But it's still a really complicated, messy process with people when people wait years, you know, in a situation like that where you're trying to, say, move, you know, a Mexican to the United States if it's
but,
your
but
wife.
But are bigger numbers coming legally than they did before? Is it just moving from the illegal column to the legal column? Is that what's going
there
on?
It's clear that there is an element of substitution. I mean, one of the things that's really substantial here is just in terms of temporary visas. The consulate in Mexico has completely changed its tune. In the old days, if you had been in the United States illegally and you were subject to these 3- or 10-year bans, they said, forget it, go home. We don't want you. Now they're saying, apply for a waiver. And so 85% of those are being approved, which means the majority of the temporary agricultural workers in the United States for Mexico used to be illegal. So there is clear substitution, and this is a policy that, you know, one guy, Ed McKeon, basically said this seems to make sense when he came in a few years ago, and that's something that's slowly moving through the system.
Is it one but for one substitution? So, you know, you've got 500,000 or 400,000 fewer illegals, but 400,000 more legals, or not, or some
fraction? It's nowhere near that, in part because the H-2A agricultural program is small. We're talking 52,000 people with visas for temporary workers last year. So that's the thing. The system clearly still needs to be fixed and worked on, and people on all sides of this debate will tell you that. But there has been some changes that have given people some hope on the temporary worker flow and in terms of, say, family relatives. So because so many Mexicans have recently become citizens, people who have had the chance to do so, they have the opportunity to bring in their family members, and they've been doing so at a higher rate. Mm. So there are a few categories of visas that have had significant growth. So there's definitely some substitution, but it doesn't mean that it's nearly enough to match demand. And one of the sort of final points I just want to make is that we're not saying in this – the research that I've seen and the reporting that I've done doesn't say that Mexican immigration will fall to zero or that it is zero. And if the American economy comes back, it doesn't mean there won't be more people crossing the border. The point is that the peaks of the past decade, the peaks of the past 15 to 20 years that have really shaped the American debate are very unlikely to return. And so the question is, how does the debate move forward when, you know, the information and the topic that has basically, we have an outdated vision of it as a country on both sides of the border. So the question is, what do we do now if we update those assumptions?
Well, it's remarkable reporting, and we really appreciate you doing it, Damian, to help us update, as you say, the framework through which we look at all this. I know you've got reporting to do there and more to come in your work on Mexico there from Tijuana and beyond. But Damian, thanks for your reporting, and thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Catherine Donato in Nashville, we just got you for another few seconds here, but Ref says he doesn't feel so comfy in Mexico City. How do you respond to that briefly?
Well, what he said was that he wouldn't want to get on the roads, and I agree that driving in Mexico is definitely complicated by the drug activity. So I don't recommend that. To the extent you can avoid it, that's a good thing. But the economy is very strong in Mexico, and the educational reforms have been big. And this has changed Mexico for the 21st century.
And we will be watching the fallout from all those changes. Catherine Donato at Vanderbilt, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And Roberto Neal Garcia, we wish you luck there with the whole of Mexican economy and, you know, heaven help us all sharing this continent and working together. May we make the most of it, the best of it. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ashbrook. It's fun to have talked to you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.